I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to the Functional Nerds. John, this should be episode number 271.
Well, I'm sure people are keeping track of the ones, and we'll call you out if you list the wrong episode. But that is Patrick Hester. He's an author and a blogger and a podcaster, and you can check out his website, atfmb.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at atfmb.
God, don't look at the website right now. I haven't done shit there.
Just follow him on Twitter at ATFMB. My name is John Anilio. I am a teacher and a musician and a composer and a podcaster as well. And you can follow me on Twitter at John Anilio. And today we're joined by Stephanie Burgess. And she was born in Michigan, but now lives in Wales with her husband. That's so there's right. quite a time difference between us. And before becoming a full-time writer, she studied music history as a Fulbright scholar in Vienna, Austria, and worked as a website editor for a British opera company. She published over 30 short stories for adults. And her new book, out through Pyre, is called Masks and Shadows, which I have right here. Okay, and this is a book about music and all sorts of other good stuff, and I'm looking forward to getting into that. And Stephanie, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. And I got so much credit with my husband when I told him that I'd been invited to join you guys, because he'd been telling me for months that I need to start listening to this podcast. It was on my list. So.
Oh, well, that's great. We always love to hear that.
And it's funny because I just had a conversation with someone at Pyre where they're like, no, we sent you a book. We sent you a book. I'm like, I haven't gotten a book from you guys in a long time. I think I just figured it out. They sent it to John.
Yeah. Well, you can request to get books sent to you too, Patrick, because, you know, a while ago I had been like, I don't want to get more books. I'm getting too many. And then I was like, but I miss getting all the books. So I actually emailed them back and be like, yeah, if you want to send me books. So I did get this book. And when I looked at it, when I saw all the music connection, I'm like, ooh, that we can get Stephanie on the show and talk a little bit about that. So we actually have, as long, long time listeners of the show know, we go way back with Pyre. That was sort of
back in the day when Lou was there. Yeah.
Yeah. I would say, like, for the first 6 months of the show, we could have been called Pyrecast for a while. we had Lou on all the time, and we had like all of those authors on, and
fantastic.
We spread out to some other folks too, but we go way back with Pyre.
Now Renee's doing all that stuff.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I was so happy when I heard that Renee had that job, because, you know, I'd known her via her short stories before, actually as an author, you know. And so it turned out to be this fantastic coincidence that I'm now getting published by her, and she's my editor, and it's wonderful.
So John, if our Patreon backers are watching us live stream right now, Stephanie has a very interesting microphone.
Yes.
What kind of mic is that, John?
I don't know. Stephanie, you tell us about it. I can't tell from where you are.
Well, I'm going to be reading what I see on it, because this is the microphone that was sitting buried in our office. We recently moved house, and I'm afraid of making that microphone come unplugged if I move the computer around to show the watchers the horror of our office. But it's full of boxes still. And this was the microphone we could dig out. It says something like Zoom.
Oh.
H1 Zoom.
Oh, wow. That's the H1?
Does that mean anything?
Yes. Wow.
Yeah, Patrick and I use, although I can't find mine now, we use, if we are recording remotely at a con or something, we use the Zoom H. Do you have the H2, Patrick?
I have the H2, yeah.
Yeah, so that's just like a standalone recorder where you don't need to plug it into a computer. You can just, records on its own, and then you plug it into a computer and you can download the file onto your computer. They're very good units for that. So.
I think Murr has upgraded to like the H19A27 Digital XB Pyre.
There's all sorts of ones now. One that I've seen recently is Zoom makes one geared towards musicians who do like YouTube videos. So they have a camera for the video, and the camera's good. It's probably not the highest quality camera, but the mics are like super top notch, because they figured like, well, if you're doing like YouTube videos of yourself performing, you probably want the audio to be as good as possible. So I know Absolutely. Zoom markets towards the YouTube crowd with that. So what else did you talk about this week on Gear Talk?
I know, right? Yeah, let's just keep talking about microphones for a while.
Yeah, I think a lot of our listeners are podcasters and other kinds of people, so I'm sure that's interesting.
Well, I was happy. I saw Patrick's wearing a Doctor Who shirt, right,
yes.
TARDIS?
Yes, I am. Like, you never forget your first Doctor.
Well, we are matching. I don't know if you can see on mine. I also have Doctor Who and what's the Doctor Who Harry Potter mashup t-shirt.
Nice.
That's completely my thing.
Nice, nice. Well, you know, before we get into the main interview, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And Stephanie, why don't you go first if you have that?
Yes. Well, I've actually gone through great angst over the last week trying to decide what to do. My husband forbade me to actually use his book as pick of the week because it's too nepotistic. Because that was my automatic. I was going to do that. I really do love his books. But the other book that I just read recently that I really loved, it's not actually science fiction or fantasy, but I think it's still got the same genre appeal. It's called A Study in Charlotte, and it's by Brittany Cavallaro, and it's Holmes and Watson. It's YA, Holmes and Watson, in a boarding school, and Holmes is a girl for once, and Watson is still a boy, and they are actually descendants of the original Holmes and Watson. It's all really thought out. Brittany Cavallaro is clearly the biggest Holmes geek ever, you know, and I'm saying that in a really, really impressed way, because I love the Sherlock Holmes stories.
Wow, I do too.
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you bring that up because another guest that we're having coming up on a future episode of the podcast is Ryan Britt, who's written for Tor.com, and he has a book out called Luke Skywalker Can't Read, which I'm a big fan of, and he has a whole chapter about Sherlock Holmes and how he, you know, that's a big thing for him, and he sort of considers that in a lot of ways, writes about how that's in a lot of ways one of the first sort of genre kind
Absolutely.
Of things, you know, before genre was genre, you had Sherlock Holmes, and he talks a lot in the book about how that's had a big influence and how that's referenced in so many different genre properties. And
I think there's something about the tone. I know it's not spec fic, but somehow it feels like it fits in the same space for me, at least in my head.
Well, and that's why I always tell people one of my favorite anthologies that John Joseph Adams ever edited is called The Improbable Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
And it takes him into that spec fic realm in a big way.
Oh,
like
perfect.
Stephen King wrote some, and there's like Cthulhu and the Old Ones and I mean Supernatural and Aliens and you name it, it's in that. And that's one of my favorite ones.
I need to find that anthology.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. That's cool. So say the name and the author again, just so our listeners can
Absolutely.
Check it out.
It's A Study in Charlotte, as in Charlotte, a girl's name, by Brittany Cavallaro. And it's just so smart. It's so fun. I thought I had gotten kind of sick of Sherlock Holmes retellings. I mean, I'm still enjoying, I'm really enjoying the BBC show Sherlock.
Yes.
I'm
yeah.
a big fan of that. I think it's problematic, but it's wonderful. It's brilliant. I thought I had gotten tired of different retellings of it. I thought it had been sort of done enough, and then I read this book, and I can't wait for book two.
Have you seen,
I really, really loved it.
Have you seen there's going to be a TV show called Doyle and Houdini?
I did not.
And it's
that is interesting.
Because they were contemporaries, it's going to be Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Harry Houdini solving mysteries and crimes and having adventures together.
Oh, that is fascinating. I read years ago a biography of Arthur Conan Doyle because I really am a big Holmes geek. And
well, they got into a huge fight.
Huge fight over, you know, supernatural and whether
yes.
it was actually real and whether Conan Doyle was just falling
right.
for scams.
Well, because Conan Doyle's wife was a medium.
Mm-hmm.
And Houdini thought that it was that the mediums were just people who were preying on the folks who had lost someone. When he lost his mother, he tried to go to mediums because he wanted to contact his mother. And they got into this huge, huge fight over – I mean, they were friends before that. But then Houdini was like, no, you're just taking advantage of people.
Right. Yeah, so that sounds like a really interesting dynamic for a TV show.
So, John, as you can tell, I know a little bit about Sherlock Holmes and Arthur.
Oh, that's good. We know when we interview Ryan, that was going to be one of my big questions to him. So we can definitely nerd out on that too. You know, before I move on to my pick, I wanted to just mention if you have Netflix and if you've watched Master of None, which is Aziz Ansari's comedy, which I enjoyed. There's a great scene where they're watching Sherlock on Netflix, like so it's very meta, and it's just him and his friends sitting there watching. They're like, I can watch Cumberbatch do anything all day. We're all just like sitting there mesmerized by it. And that is so the reaction that I think everybody universally has to Cumberbatch.
I think so. And I mean, I really meant it when I said that I find some things about the new Sherlock show very problematic, but that doesn't change the fact that I will watch every single episode.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Cool. Well, my pick this week is it's books and it's kind of a platform. And that is, I use a service called the 3M Cloud Library, which is an audio and ebook service that libraries use. So
what's it called?
It's called 3M Cloud Library. And it's an app that you can get on your phone and your iPad and all that kind of jazz. And depending on the library system that you use, this is how they don't actually buy the books. They license them. And I just read a book about libraries recently about that. So they license ebooks and they license audiobooks, and you borrow them and you borrow for 2 weeks. And what I've found is that I'm listening to a lot of audiobooks these days through this service. And I've really been focusing almost exclusively on nonfiction. I like listening to fiction as audiobooks, too. I tend to prefer to read it, to actually read an ebook or a paper book with fiction. I like the audiobooks. The problem when I listen to fiction as an audiobook is that I find I get lost sometimes. Like, I'll zone out for a second, and then I'm like, I have no idea what's going on. I have to back it up. With nonfiction, I just find it easier to sort of stay in the headspace, and if you miss a second of it, you're not totally lost in the story, so I just find it tends to work a little better for me. So that's the service that I'm using, and two recent nonfiction books that I read or listened to or have, whatever you want to say. Some people are just like, audiobooks is not reading. I think it is. But I think it is. Yeah, you can make whatever argument you want. But I recently listened and read two of the Malcolm Gladwell books. One is David and Goliath, and the other is Outliers. I read the first two chapters of Outliers, like, you know, when that book first came out, and I never read the whole book. I must have quoted the 10,000 hours rule a million times on this podcast from that book, because that's in the first two chapters. But when I saw it up there, I'm like, I should actually really finish that book and read it. And I like it. You know, I like Gladwell as a writer. I think he has some interesting insights into data and trying to find different reasons for
things. Lieutenant Commander Data?
No, not that data. Different, you know.
If only.
Yes. But those are two recent books. So I would recommend checking out those two books by Gladwell. And, you know, if you're not someone who's a regular patron of your libraries, go and check it out. Go check out your website. If you make sure your card's up to date, I bet the chance is good that they have an ebook, an audiobook loaning system, whether it's this 3M or something different. And it's wonderful, especially if you have a modern phone. Why not take advantage of that? Your taxes are paying for the library to license these books. You know, use it. And that helps authors out, too. The more their books are borrowed, it helps them. And then if they have a book, you know, they don't have a book by an author you don't like, then go buy the book or buy the audiobook or do whatever you can. I'm a true believer in that reading begets more reading. So the more you can do, you take advantage of your library and do it. So that's my pick this week. Patrick, what is your pick this week?
So, John, have you ever heard of a thing called Google Play?
I have.
Have you heard of Google Play Music?
Yes, that one I don't use, but yes, I have heard of it.
So Google Play Music sent me an email.
Hmm.
So that was kind of scary.
Okay.
Because I don't normally get emails from Google. But anyway, my pick this week is that the Functional Nerds podcast and the Hugo Award-winning SF Signal podcast are now available on Google Play Music.
Oh, nice.
So I went through that whole rigmarole with DiNardo over on SF Signal. We got both of the podcasts listed, and you can now, if you're a Google Play Music person, you can now stream our podcasts via that service.
Excellent. That's very great. Nice. Yeah, I use Google Play for when I want to buy a movie or buy a like a TV show that's not on Netflix or something. I use Google Play because they let you use PayPal. So
nice.
So Amazon does not let you use PayPal. So gotcha. So I like Google Play for that. So if my son wants a movie, I buy it through that, or I buy all the Star Wars stuff through Google Play. So
gotcha.
It's a good if you have like the app on your screen. It's good, but that's good to know about the music too. I mean, that's I know there's lots of, you know, Google does a lot of stuff these days. They kind of throw a lot of different things out there mm-hmm. that you can't always follow. So that's good. Yeah, if you're a Google user, go check it out.
So, John, we have one person watching our live streaming right now. How much you want to bet that it's MB Partlow?
I'm not going to take that action.
So you better start dancing.
I know. This is one of our listeners who, as far as the, you know, the perks for the show, she wants us to be dancing mm-hmm. on tables and things. So that's, which, you know, I'll do anything for our listeners, but I don't know about that one.
office is just too crowded.
Yeah. But Stephanie, you know, so I have to know, before we get into mm-hmm. anything, I have to know about your studying of music history in Vienna. That seems the perfect place to study music history. I can't think of a better place.
It was amazing. When I first wrote my original Fulbright application, and I took it to my music history advisor at my undergraduate college, which was Oberlin Conservatory of Music, she looked at me and she said, you know, all I can really tell from your application essay is that you want to sit in Vienna and eat apple strudel. And I said, well, that's really accurate. But she said, I think you have to go a little further. And it was fantastic. The first time I went to Vienna was actually part of an exchange program. And we were studying with Schoenberg's last student, who is a professor at my conservatory, and he took us back to Vienna. And we did courses through the University of Vienna, and we did courses with him in Schoenberg's old house. It's, you know, modern... Not that it's that modern anymore. 20th century music wasn't really my specialty anyway, but it was an amazing experience. And then I went back and I got to study more of my kind of music, which is the much older stuff. My big specialty was 18th century opera. And
I thought you were going to say, like, you know, Buddy Holly.
No. A lot of my friends, but not me. But yeah, 18th century opera was my shtick, and 18th century Viennese opera. So it was an amazing place to be. And I ended up spending about 2 years living in Vienna, all in all, and going to the opera all the time.
Now, to back up a bit, you know, what you said, you were an undergraduate student at Oberlin. Mm-hmm. What was your, now, if your opera was, especially, were you a voice major to start too? What was your primary instrument?
Terrible voice. I was a French horn performance major, which is what I started out as. I thought I was going to play in an orchestra, because I thought when I was a kid, if you love music, the two options, at least that I knew about in high school, was I could be a musician, or I could be a band teacher. And I really didn't want to be a band teacher, actually. It wasn't my thing at all. So I thought, fine, I'll be an orchestra musician. And then I got to conservatory, and it turns out there are all these other options. Mm-hmm. And I come from a family of academics, actually, so it sort of runs in the blood. And I always loved history. And so when I figured out that I could actually combine those two things, I mean, that was magic. Obviously, that was just right for me. And so I could study, I could be as close to opera as I wanted to be, but actually thinking about it and writing about it. And, you know, I like writing in any form. So
yeah, that's convenient.
Yeah, it's good. It works out. I teach fourth and fifth grade band students, and I have this one fourth grader who's a trumpet player, and he's doing really well. And he's just got this thing for the French horn. He wants to move to the French horn, which we usually don't start that young, but he's doing so well, and I want to encourage him to do it. Because French horn, for anybody that knows anything about brass instruments, when I took my brass methods class in college, French horn, your embouchure, it's really much more challenging than, say, playing a trumpet, in that it's very difficult to be accurate with which notes you're hitting by how tight or loose you're buzzing.
Oh, yeah.
For people, you know, not to get too down the rabbit hole with this, but, you know, when you play a saxophone or a clarinet, basically you're putting your mouth on the mouthpiece, there's the reed in there, you blow on it, the reed vibrates, that's what makes your sound. On a brass instrument, it's your lips buzzing that makes the sound. It's you that's making the sound. And it's very difficult. Brass instruments are very physical to play. You can lose your technique on it if you don't keep your practice up with it very easily. French horn is like, I just remember it's so easy to just hit the wrong note. It's like, oh, I went up a fifth and I did not want to do that, and I can't get my so it's very challenging. What were your particular challenges in playing the French horn, and how far did you make it with that?
Oh, well, I did my degree, my undergraduate degree in performance. I just added in music history as a double major. So I went all the way through conservatory with it, and yeah, I'm not going to embarrass myself by doing this now. At one point, because it is all your embouchure, it's all your lips, without having the French horn here with me, I could do a whole song just with the buzzing. I can't do it anymore, and I'm not going to spit into the microphone right now. But yeah, I loved playing in opera pits. I loved doing chamber music. I was part of wind quintet, which I loved. The thing I found most challenging, the reason I decided not to be an orchestral musician, was I wasn't as fond of playing in an orchestra, actually. And I remember I had a lesson with the principal horn player at the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, who was amazing. He gave me a couple lessons. It was wonderful. But he told me he had just played Brahms' Second Symphony sitting in the same chair. in the same part of the stage. He had played it for the 200th time in his career. And, you know, that's success. That is success in the orchestral field because it's so hard to get an orchestra job. I thought, I don't want to do that because I want to do something more creative.
I know exactly what you're saying. Being a musician and going to school and being with some classical, and I studied classical guitar when I was in, so it's different, but it's true. It's much more about precision and I mean, and there's creativity within it, but you're right.
Absolutely. You need to be doing emotional expression, but also as an orchestral musician, you're going for whatever expression the conductor wants. You're not making the choice yourself. You're just following someone else's orders, you know? Yeah. And that takes an enormous amount of skill, and I am so impressed by them, but it wasn't what I wanted to do.
It's a different focus of your creativity, I should say. And my father-in-law, who has his own insurance company now, but he was a clarinetist, and you know, he tried for a while too, like through his 20s and 30s, like he auditioned for all the big orchestras and made it with sort of like the B-level orchestras, and eventually was just like, you know, I don't think it's gonna happen for me. You know, it's like trying to become a rock star, you know.
Exactly,
it's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's the same odds, really, you know.
And John, you know, I miss that we don't have like the, I know this is a silly example, but I kind of miss that we don't have the Desi Arnaz house band in the restaurant.
That'd be so great.
You know, kind of thing. Like, you remember that on I Love Lucy?
Oh, sure.
And it used to be that you would go out and it was like an evening and everybody got dressed up and you'd have dinner and there'd be some sort of band and playing. Mm. Mm-hmm. I miss that kind of stuff because I love a big band like that, like an orchestra.
Yes.
Well, you know, there's a lot that, you know, we see so much today about how technology is killing music. This has been a refrain in music for hundreds of years. Nothing new. When I remember someone telling me a story, it's like, when sound in movies started,
right?
Musicians were like, oh, well, that's the end of our jobs, because there used to be people that were employed to like play piano with silent movies. That was a job for a musician. And so every advance in technology, you know, destroys musicians' livelihood, except for the fact that there's usually new jobs that come up because of it, new music. So it's, you know, just have to roll with it. But that's musicians are the worst for that in terms of like.
I would say writers compete with them. Yes. But that's been happening since the printing press was invented. Right? Everyone said, this is the end of book. This is the end of, you know, writing. Because you've lost all the beauty of hand illustrations and so on.
So, you know, we could talk music all day. So, and you're, all right, let's just do it. but before we go too much down one particular, maybe you could tell us how you make that, I don't want to say transition, but how you take your studies in music and you start working in towards your writing. Obviously, you wrote a lot of short stories and now you have your current book, which has a music focus. Mm-hmm. How to, you know, maybe give us a little bit of insight into how that side of your creativity developed.
Right. Well, actually, I need to give credit to another writer. I don't know if you were doing all those early interviews with Pyre, if you came across her, because I know she published fairly early on with Pyre, Justina Robson.
Sure.
Writes these fantastic books, and she was my landlady in Leeds, where I was living while I was a PhD student, and landlady and good friend. It was really convenient. We lived down the street, so we could every day, you know, sort of go over and knock and have some tea and avoid writing. But anyway, so we used to talk, and I was writing all of these random, different fantasy short stories. I was working on drafts of novels, and she said, you spend the other half of your life, you know, doing all this intense focus on music history. Why don't you ever do something with it, with your writing? I mean, why don't you actually use that since you're obviously interested? And so, you know, it took a while, obviously, for the result of that to come into the world. But in fact, that was what I started doing. And I started thinking about sort of fictional potential as I was doing my PhD research, because I came across all this stuff. I mean, just really interesting random stuff from the period I was researching, which was late 18th century Vienna and Esterhazy. And Esterhazy was the palace in Hungary where Haydn was the court composer. So he sort of got gathered up into my PhD thesis along with Vienna. And there were all these weird things going on. You know, there were just a bunch of secret societies. There were a bunch of alchemists. And it wasn't just, I grew up hearing that, oh, alchemy was just the name for science, you know, in the old days. But it wasn't always. There were a lot of con men, actually, and a lot of people who would do sort of the 18th century version of those 19th century seances. You know, they would have these salon. They would hold these salons where they would pretend to, you know, they would say, "Oh, I'm summoning up these elementals," and you know, doing all these really interesting stuff. And of course, historically, we look back and say, "Yes, isn't this interesting? How they con people into believing it?" But as a science fiction and fantasy reader, I was thinking, "Wouldn't it be fun if it was real?" And you know, I was reading one book. Yeah, if I was reading one book on Mozart's The Magic Flute, and there was a chapter title, and it said, "Why did the Freemasons visit hell?" And obviously, this was symbolic. It was just a ritual. You know, they did this thing where symbolically they would do it. But I thought, again, what if it wasn't symbolic? Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah, I was gonna say, you know, with science and with alchemy, you know, I did read a couple of biographies on Isaac Newton, and you know, he spent for as many scientific breakthroughs and all of his contributions to the world, he spent a lot of his time on alchemy.
At least he did.
At least according to the couple from one of them, it seems like he spent more time on that than anything else. Like that was what he did. Like they were, some people were convinced that that was going to happen. I'm sorry.
It wasn't obvious. I phrased it badly before. I shouldn't have said they were all con men. I mean, there were people who are really sincerely, you know, passionate about the quest to discover these, you know, sort of other realms and so on.
Right. Well, and they did. They looked at it as a how can we prove this?
Exactly.
Right. How can we? Mm. Is this something that's real or is this fake or how does this work?
Absolutely. And nowadays we think, well, obviously, you know, whatever. But at the time, it wasn't obvious. You could be very intelligent and it could be a real possibility for you. And so as a historical fantasist, you know, it's fun to go back and say, well, what if it was? What if it was real? What if it was possible?
Now, you know, you said you briefly mentioned that Haydn was one of your inspirations, or you know, someone that you worked with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, is there anything specifically that about Haydn that, other than his connection to this world, that you found particularly interesting?
Well, he was a fascinating guy. I mean, he was one of the great composers in history. A lot like Mozart, and yet he had the opposite career while living at the same time, because you know Mozart, he wanted to be free, he wanted to be independent in a time when you couldn't financially survive that way. You had to work for an aristocratic or you know some kind
of. You had to have a patron.
Yes.
Yes.
And Mozart could not stand that because he wanted the creative independence, and Haydn lived his entire life working for the Esterhazys, and so he created some of the most amazing music ever, but it was all very much working to specific tastes, someone else's taste that wasn't his, which isn't the way we think about, you know, music and composition nowadays. But so, you know, for instance, with his operas, which I studied, one of the things that was actually very frustrating to him was he had to write his operas to the taste of his employer. And his employer liked these really, really, you know, long arias and so on, which you couldn't get away with on the stage in Vienna. And so his operas didn't get performed, you know, in other places. And so he was one of the great composers in the world, and he's having to write music that isn't what he thinks is the best. You know, he's writing it to a different person's preferences. And yet, you know, for all that creative frustration, that didn't stop him from being one of the great composers. He didn't produce mediocre work because of it.
Yeah, I would say like a parallel today would be, and which is the way many composers, you know, the most successful composers, I think you can argue, are the film composers, and they're composing their music for film, for somebody else's vision. It's still their music, but yes, they're composing for a very specific person. And if you look back on the past 50 years or 100 years, some of those film composers have put out amazing, collections of works that, you know, was for a job that they had to have this done by the state, and we have to get it done.
But sometimes I would say that's actually really good for people of any artistic career, creatively. Actually, getting those limitations can produce some of the most amazing work in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, unfortunately, like we're running out of time. I do want to mention, if you enjoy all the stuff that you've been hearing Stephanie talk about, her book is out now. So again, it's called Masks and Shadows. I'm holding it up as if this is a video show.
That's fine. No, there's people watching.
Yeah. So it's Masks and Shadows. It's got a great cover, as Pyre covers always tend to be. And it's Stephanie Burgess, B-U-R-G-I-S. So you can get the print, you can get the ebook and all that good stuff. So look it up if you like this period of history and music history and hearing Stephanie's background. I know it makes me want to put this to the top of my to-be-read list now, too. So that is wonderful. You can check out Stephanie's website, which is stephanieburgess.com, and she's on Facebook and Twitter, just as her name. Ooh, you got your name. That's always important.
That's early on Twitter.
Yeah. So there you go with that. One of the things that I want to mention that brought up, which I usually mention earlier in the show, but we were talking about patrons, and is that we have a Patreon. If you enjoy what we do with the show, having authors and other creative people like Stephanie on the show, consider becoming one of our patrons over at patreon.com/functionalnerds. You can put any amount you want, $1, $5 a month, whatever works for you. There's different levels. You can get access to the live stream like we're doing now. You can get early access to special shows that don't show up in our feed.
Like the Star Wars show that we did.
Like the Star Wars show that we did. Yeah, so all good stuff. And if you just dig the show, it means a lot to us. You can join the over 40 people that are backing us now. We want to thank those 40 people right now for backing us. It really means a lot.
John, I've decided if we hit $150 a month,
which we're very close to right
very
now.
Very close to. If we hit $150 a month, we're not there yet. If we do, okay, for the next live stream, I will wear my MailChimp knitted hat the entire live stream.
Okay. Well, come on, people.
Exactly. You want to see that. Trust me.
All right. Well, that is about it for us this week.
I have
week.
One and final question for Stephanie.
Yes. Oh, please. Go for it.
Would you care for a jelly baby?
That's awesome.
So once again, yeah, go check out Mask and Shadows by Stephanie. Back us on the podcast. Patrick, anything else you want to let our listeners know about?
I just want to let them know that if they weren't watching that or not seeing the live stream, they totally missed that joke.
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll get half of Patrick's jokes now. Come on, that's worth it right there. Most of Patrick's jokes are visual, so there you go. All right, Stephanie, thank you for joining us. Everyone else, thank you for joining us this week, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?